good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, January the 18th, 2018. 1-18-18. Scott Spears along with you here on the Now program, 13 coming up on 14 minutes past the hour. And today, we have a guest who I am truly honored to have on the program. He is one of the original Tuskegee Airmen. He's an Ohioan, Professor Dr. Harold Brown. Dr. Brown, how are you?
I am just great.
It is a pleasure to speak with you. How's the weather where you are in Ohio?
It's moderating. It's up into the high 20s now, which is a relief, but there's a very strong wind, and you know what that means. The wind chill is going in the other direction.
That is right. You know, this Ohio winter's been a little more rough than in the past.
Well, you lived a good life for 2 or 3 years. Now you got to pay for it.
That's exactly right. Dr. Brown, what an amazing life you've led. How did it all start? Tell me where you grew up and what your childhood was like.
Well, I was born and raised in Minneapolis, Minnesota. At that time, the Afro-American population was very small, less than a fractional part of 1%. But there's where it all happened. Integration was a very, very common thing to me. In my school that I went to, granted there were only a few of us there, but we were completely integrated. My neighborhood I lived in was integrated. There were Swedish people on one side, Polish people on the other side, Jewish people right down the block from me, and a couple of Latino families right behind me. And this was at the time when no one had any money. The Great Depression, as you know, that occurred in 1929. So we were all there. We were all poor. We had no locks on the front door because there wasn't anything to steal.
When you were growing up, what did you want to be when you grew up?
That was very simple for me. And when I was in the sixth grade, I was 11 years old, and I refer to it as having a love affair with an airplane. And I don't know how it happened or why it happened, but one day that was the case. And I just loved the whole thought of flying. The next thing came building all the little models out of balsam wood and using rubber bands to propel the propellers. And they, most of them, flew. And I continue that. I read every book I could find at the local library. There was one in particular. It was Randolph Field, Texas, West Point of the Air. And it talked about the life of an Army Air Corps flying cadet. And I bet I read that book every Saturday morning until I've almost memorized it. And that continued on until I was up 16 years old. And I worked, as a paper boy when I was 11, 12 years old. Then in the drugstore, I was a delivery boy. And when I was 16 years old, I saved enough money to go out to World Chamberlain and take 5 flying lessons, hoping that I could make more money so I could continue my flying lessons. However, that was not the case, but nevertheless, that was my actual introduction to really flying, and that all occurred in 1941. But another very interesting thing happened in 1941. There was a great debate that started in 1939, and the debate that occurred up in Congress was, should we allow color folks to fly airplanes? Is it worth it? Should we or shouldn't we? And there was a resounding no way from the War Department that said that it'd be the biggest waste of money we could possibly spin. And that's the way the argument went. And it went up until 1941, until Franklin Roosevelt stepped in and said, okay, that's it. We are going to triumph. So that was pretty much what happened to me up until the time I was a senior in high school.
Do you remember where you were and what you were doing when Pearl Harbor happened?
Oh, I remember very, very well. I was over to a friend of mine's house, and he was an airplane builder, and we used to go over there quite often. And that day when we first heard about it, I was over at his house. We were working on an airplane, and I thought, oh, my goodness, now what? But you see, an interesting thing has happened. Roosevelt made his announcement about providing us military flight instructions in March of 1941, and the first class was announced in July of 1941. That was 6 months before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. So I already knew before that happened that the door was now open for me to get into military flight training 6 months before Pearl Harbor happened.
The Tuskegee Institute, for people who don't know what that was, what was it? Where was it?
Well, Tuskegee Institute, which was one of the predominant black colleges in those years, matter of fact, it still exists today, it is now Tuskegee University, is located 35 miles due east of Montgomery, Alabama. And it's nothing but a crossroads, and the biggest thing there is the college. Now, it just so happened that I was down there this summer visiting for the first time in almost 20-some years on a big book signing deal when my book came out. And that is a huge campus, which has much land. It's absolutely gorgeous, beautiful. It has quite a reputation. It offers a variety of different programs. It is well attended. I can't tell you what the student population is, but I am guessing that it is probably close to 5,000-6,000 down there now. And it is now Tuskegee University. When I went there, it was Tuskegee Institute. But that's where it's located, 35 miles east of Montgomery, Alabama.
How did it come about that that was the chosen place for people of color of that time to become pilots?
Well, you have to know a little bit of the history. In 1939, someone with good foresight in the Congress decided what we need is a civilian pilot training program. And when that program came up for authorization for funding it, a representative located out in Idaho, whose name I now forget, recommended a revision to that bill, which allowed for six of the predominantly black colleges to participate in the civilian pilot training program. And at that time, Tuskegee Institute had a pilot training program that they were just beginning to start, and they also had a very large program in aviation mechanics there. So they were at the top of the list, and so they rapidly became the premier school for the civilian pilot training program in 1939. And they had the best record out of the six schools. The first 100 students that entered the program in those six schools, the vast 91% or 91 out of 100 completely finished successfully that basic program, and the vast majority of those students who completed the program, completed it at Tuskegee Institute. So they were high on the list in terms of flight training.
1941, this ball kind of gets rolling. How did you end up at the Tuskegee Institute?
Well, initially, you go back, and they wanted all college graduates or people with a reasonable number of colleges for acceptance in the military flight training. And that they maintained. Once the war started, they used up the small pool of pilots, and it was a small pool of people of that were college trained, and they used them up so fast that it was depleted. And they needed not hundreds, but thousands of pilots. And so someone said, wait a minute, let's take high school graduates if they can pass the mental and physical examinations. So when I graduated from high school in 1942 at 17 years of age, I immediately went down and set for military flight training, since the program now allowed high school students to do that. I successfully passed all the programs, I mean all the tests, the written and the physical tests. Then my paperwork, that occurred in July, June of 1942. Everyone but myself and I was the only person of color sitting there. There's about 105 of us. But I scored number 5 on the list. All the rest of them who successfully passed were immediately sworn into the reserve, and they were protected from the draft while they were waiting a class assignment. My paperwork had to go to Washington, D.C., because that is where the selection was made for people that looked like me to enter into this program. And the reason why it was sent there, there was a quota system, and they were only going to allow X number of people into the program. And unfortunately, there were literally hundreds of guys like me that were sitting, waiting for a class assignment, and the draft caught up with them. And they never received a response to that initial letter of passing all of those examinations. And keep in mind, they only trained 992 of us over the entire 5 years, the length of the program, from 1941 to 1946. And the quota is what controlled it.
Amazing. When you left Minneapolis and went to Alabama in 1941, segregation very much still in play. What was it like to go to Alabama?
That's very interesting. My mother was born in Talladega, Alabama. My father was born in Juniper, Alabama, and relocated up to Talladega. He was the youngest of 9 children. They were part of the great migration that was getting out of Alabama. And of course, here I am. I am making application. I've been accepted to go back to Alabama for flight training. And my mother sat down and now started all of the lectures. Now, Harold, this is how you have to behave. They'll do this. You got to say yes, ma'am. Yes, and she went through all of it, and I was sitting there poo-pooing the whole idea. Oh, Mama, come on, Mama. She says, now listen to me, boy. Listen to me. I know. I was born and raised there. And it went on and on until the day I left. And it wasn't until I took that train out of Minneapolis to Chicago and then switched trains and took the from Chicago to Biloxi, Mississippi, when I got down in Nashville, that is when it hit me. As I was changing trains, I went in to the place where you get the tickets, and I asked the gentleman, sir, can you tell me on which track the train for Biloxi, Mississippi comes in on? And he said, well, young man, you go right around the corner there and someone would help you. So I said, okay, and I walked around the corner, and the same gentleman came up to me and asked me the exact same question. And I thought, well, that looks awful strange. So I asked him the question, and they told me they came in on track 4. And then as I walked away, I looked up, and I saw a great big college sign over the window. So I went back and looked at the other window, and it had white on that window. So that was my introduction to the good Southland.
Mm. What was it like at the Tuskegee Institute in those days?
Well, as you know, everything was segregated, and the Tuskegee Institute is where we were all at. And most of us pretty much stayed on the base. There was nothing in the town, and it was better for us to stay out of the town because everything was segregated in town, and there wasn't anything to go in the town worth seeing. So we were affected very, very little. We stayed on the base. We minded our own business on the base, even though we were on a segregated base. That was primarily for the officers, the white officers, and the rest of them that were running the base. It didn't pretty much bother us. You know, that's the way it was. It was segregation, and we were in the South, and we were all wise enough to know what that meant. But we avoided so much of it by not even going in the town, by staying on the base. And we had a very rigorous program, and we run a quota system, so everybody is struggling, making sure that they were right at the very top of the class in order to survive and to make graduation exercises. So it didn't really bother me, and I just stayed on the base. I think I went in the town once during the entire time that I was down there, some 13, 14 months in Tuskegee going through the program.
After your training was complete and you entered the active war, World War II, what did you do in the war and how were you treated by the other soldiers?
Well, I graduated in 44E, which was May of 1941. All the entire Air Corps cadet training program was on the exact same schedule. I completed my program, like I said, in May of 1944. I graduated. I was commissioned a second lieutenant, and I received my silver ring. I went home for 1 week, obviously on cloud nine. I was the local hero for a few days. When I left home, I was sent to Walderboro, South Carolina, for my combat fighter pilot training. And that is where they had all of us guys who completed Tuskegee. That's where we got our fighter training at. We trained for combat fighter pilots for approximately 2.5 months. That training started in June and went up through the middle of August, at which time I completed it. And then we boarded our ships to go overseas to join the 332nd Fighter Group, which was the group that was made up of black pilots. They had gone overseas much earlier, and they were already over and fighting the war. And the way they were fighting the war, they were assigned to the 15th Air Force, which was strategic bombing, 8th Air Force. And their primary duty was to protect the bombers, take them on those long ranges deep up into targets up in Germany, and to bring them home safely. That was our duty. And our commander, D.O. Davis Jr., who was a West Pointer, graduated from West Point in 1936, when he said, those are your duties, and don't you dare do anything else except to protect those bombers, and you only engage fighters if they attempt to disrupt the bombers. And that's what we did. And after a short while, we became known as the Red Tail Angels. And bomber guys, after they found out who we were, they started actually requesting us, saying, boy, those guys really stick with us. And the bomber losses were much less when we were protecting the bombers. So that was quite a thing. As a matter of fact, as an interesting sideline, Colonel Bill Davis, our group commander, changed the name of his aircraft to By Request, because so many of the bomber groups were starting to request us for their fighter escort.
Mm. You were in the war and shot down. Tell me about the day you were shot down.
Well, that's a very memorable day, to say the least. But we were assigned a special strafing mission, which came to the 332nd Fighter Group. And I was in the 99th Fighter Squadron, and our squadron was assigned to that strafing mission. This mission was up to Linz, Austria, where we were to strafe about 100 miles from Linz, Austria, southwest for about 100 miles. It was an extremely successful mission. There was much chatter going on. We put up about 20 airplanes. Every airplane we could get off the ground, the squadron could get off the ground, and we had a very successful day. There was just chatter all over it. You could just hear the guys, hey, I just got one. Did you see that one blow up? Boy, such and such. And it went on and on and day. Very successful. And I was in the Lee's flight, flying the wing of our squadron commander. And as we were finishing up the mission, and they were circling, waiting for our flight to finish up, as things normally happen, Major Camo says, hey, Brown, we missed one. There's one over there. Let's you and I run down and get him. So we went down to get him. He had to break off because he ran out of ammunition. So I went in on the locomotive. I had it lit up like a Christmas tree right on target. And I kept saying, come on, blow up, it's time to blow up. You know, because I had to get out of there. And just as I decided I got to get out of there and I pulled up, that's when the locomotive exploded and I was caught in part of that explosion. My engine was heavily damaged. I had to bail out of the aircraft. And after having bailed out of the aircraft, the guy circled me. They saw I was safely got out of the aircraft. I was in my parachute. And I landed, and then I thought, here I am, 20 years old, all by myself with this black face, up in Germany. I got no business being up in Germany. But I was picked up, and I was taken to a little village, and we had just strafed that village. And I was met by 35 of the angriest people I have ever seen in my life. And they were angry, rightly so. We had just shot the place up. We weren't shooting at the civilians, but bullets are flying all over the place. There was collateral stuff flying all over. You blow up a locomotive, all that's flying all over the place. God knows how many people that could have been killed while we were doing all that strafing. And they had every right to be angry. So when I walked in, they had one thing on their mind. They were going to take my life. And I knew I was going to die. There was no way that I could get out of it. There I was, all by myself. And they had found, and I can still remember that tree, what I thought was a perfect hanging tree. And I'll never forget it. And as we walked towards it, there was one guy in the back, a constable, that slowly walked around, and I just kind of ignored him. The next thing I knew, he put a hand on my shoulder, snatched me back. He stepped in front of me. He put a round in his rifle, and he started screaming at that mob. Now stop and think about it. That guy knew everyone in that crowd. He was a constable there. He might have had some of his friends in that crowd. But he held them off of me and he prevented them from taking my life. And we backed up into a little pub, barricaded ourselves in there, and sometime after midnight, after the crowd had dispersed, we went out the back of the pub down to the next village, and they called someplace, and they turned me over to a couple of soldiers. So that was how close I came to dying.
Why do you think, or did you ever find out why the constable did that?
You know, my greatest regret, I came home from the war, I was 20 years old. And a 20-year-old, at that time, I wasn't thinking about going back to Germany. But as I got a little older, I stayed in the military, I often thought, Harold, take a few weeks off, go back to Germany. I knew the village where I could find the village. Find that village, and that guy may still be living. And thank him for saving your life. But the one question that I wanted to ask him, had I done that, is why? Why did you do it? You have friends in that crowd. Why did you step forward to save my life? I didn't go back. I will regret that until the day I die, but I didn't do it. But that is what I would have loved to have done. And that is the primary question I would have asked him. Why did you do it?
What was it like being a prisoner of war in Germany, Nazi Germany, during World War II?
Well, that was the safe haven. If you were fortunate enough to get into a prison camp, if you had to bail out or whatever, and if you could get into it without being caught by civilians or even some of the German soldiers and whatnot, then that was a safe haven for you. And they had thousands of prisoners. And I don't know how many prison camps they had, but they had a number of them. So there were thousands of prisoners. So here you were, you know, in a camp, barbed wire fence, absolutely nothing to do. There was no forced labor with us or nothing like that. You just sat and yikety-yike, and you just slowly was always thinking about food because the Germans hardly had enough food to feed themselves and to feed their own military. They didn't have the food. So we were fortunate enough. The International Red Cross was able to get a food parcel, or at least they tried to, one food parcel for every prisoner at least once a week. Some weeks they weren't successful, and on those weeks that they weren't, you just kind of went hungry because the poor Germans had nothing to feed you. They would come in with what looked like a great big garbage can, as they called it, soup, but it looked like plain water to me. There was nothing in it, and you got that once a day, plus you got one loaf of bread a day. But that loaf of bread had to be divided up between seven men. So you ran around with the seven guys that you shared that loaf of bread with, and each day we would take turns as to who would cut the bread up into seven slices. And we would get the loaf of bread, and we would look at it, and when we were all satisfied the way it was divided, the cutter would cut off a slice and then give you all the crumbs. Then he would cut off the next slice, give it to the next guy, along with all the crumbs. And that is how you survived. I only weighed 128 3/4 pounds when I went in, but when I was liberated, I could count the ribs on my body.
Tell me about the day you were liberated.
Well, we knew it was going to happen. I was first in Nuremberg, and that's where I was interrogated, in Nuremberg. but the Americans were getting very close, so they evacuated us, and there were 10,000 of us in Stalag 13. They marched us for approximately 2 weeks down to Mooseburg. And it was in Mooseburg, about 10 to 12 days later, that Patton came through and liberated us. Now, we knew that things were getting close. As a matter of fact, my interrogator back up in Nuremberg, FG had interrogated me, and the guy spoke perfect English. He talked about after the war, he would either go to England or he would love to get over to America. And even he acknowledged, and he just told me up front, now, Harold, the war is almost over. Don't do anything stupid. Don't try to escape because the guards will shoot you. So don't even attempt it. All you got to do is sweat out the war, and the next 4, 5, 6 months, this war is going to be over with. And he just told it to me right up front. So we knew that the war wasn't going to last much longer, and it was just a matter of not doing something crazy. Don't give them an excuse to shoot you. And we just went hungry until the day that it happened. And we could hear Patton and his men off in the distance, so we knew that they were getting close. And they came in the morning of April the 29th, you know, knocked down the fence, and in comes these great big tanks, the first two tanks, and then it was Patton and his Jeep right behind the first two tanks, followed by umpteen tanks. And he comes into this prison camp, and we had a very large number of prisoners down at Mooseburg. There were probably 80, 90, 100,000 prisoners down there. And I was pretty close to where Patton came in. I don't know if you saw the movie about Patton. Patton was a big man, about 6'2" tall, and he wore those two pistols on the side. And he was standing up on his Jeep, the hood, absolutely spotless, with his breeches and those two pistols on his side. Let me tell you a little joke about those two pistols. He was being interviewed by a reporter, and the reporter asked him, General Patton, why do you carry those two pearl-handled guns on your side? And he says, son, let me tell you something. No one but a pimp in New Orleans would carry a pearl-handled gun. These are ivory-handled guns, and don't you ever forget it. And that was supposedly a true story. But that was Patton. And, of course, we were liberated. We know now the war was over for us, and the war ended 5 days later. But you can imagine the jubilation, how happy we all were. We were all hollering and screaming and yakety-yak, because we know for us the war was over, and it would be just a matter of time before we'd all be coming home.
When you were being interrogated, what kind of information did the Germans want to know?
Well, it's interesting because the questions that they were asking me, you know, your intelligence officer down in the squadron would always tell you the same thing before you flew every mission. If you get shot down, you give them your name, Harold H. Brown, your rank, first lieutenant, and your number, AO830783, and nothing else. And if they asked you questions, you didn't respond. You would just respond with your name, your rank, and your serial number. And that is just the way it was. He was asking me questions like, Harold, from 30,000 feet where you guys normally fly at, would you be able to see hospitals if we had great big signs on the roofs of those hospitals from 30,000 feet, you know, and I would just give my name, rank, serial number? Well, obviously, we couldn't read what was on a roof from 30,000 feet. That's 5 miles up in the air. But those are the kinds of questions. And I wasn't giving him any answers. So he says, Harold, let me tell you something. I'm going to send you back to your cell. You're going to come back tomorrow. You are going to respond to every question I've asked you, or I'm going to turn you over to the civilians. Now, that would strike fear in anyone's heart. I went home, went back to the cell that night, worried to death, no sleep. What am I going to do tomorrow? So the next day when I came in, he has a big smile on his face, and he says, Harold, I know as much about your outfit as you do. Let me show you something. We went around to another room, and he had a whole library of big three-ring notebooks. He pointed to four of them, and he said, do you recognize the numbers on those books? And on the books, there was one that said 332nd FG, and then it had, one book had the 99th, one had the 100th, the 301st, and the 302nd, and those were the squadrons. And there he was. He says, I know everything about you guys. He says, I know something you don't know, Harold. He said, your intelligence officer, Captain Pitt, why, he just made major about 2 weeks ago. You didn't know that, did you? No, yeah. You know, he's telling me all this stuff. And I'm sitting there, you know, trying to play it cool and whatnot, and I'm saying, holy smokes. You know, I couldn't have told him anything that he didn't already know. But most of the information he knew was just really general information that he could have gotten out of any paper. And it's my understanding, I found out later on, that they had access to all of our newspapers. But to hear your interrogator talk like that to you was very impressive. Mm. And all I could think of was, boy, these guys are well informed. But that's the way it went.
After the war, your career went on, and you were involved in the Cuban Missile Crisis. What was your involvement there?
Well, I went to SAC, and I was flying the 6th Jet Engine B-47 bomber. We had a three-man crew. We had a pilot, a co-pilot, and a navigator. We had 1,400 B-47s in SAC, along with 80 to 90 B-52s, plus we had all of the intercontinental ballistic missiles. But each one of those 1,400 B-47s carried one weapon, and it was a 1.1 megaton bomb. That bomb was 50 times bigger than the bomb that they dropped on Hiroshima, so you know the size of it. And they have 1,400 of them. When that Cuban Missile Crisis started, shortly before then, Colonel Adams, my group commander, had asked me to give up my crew, and I had a select crew at that time, and invited me to come up to be one of his SAC controllers, which I immediately jumped at the opportunity. So I was a SAC controller when that Cuban Missile Crisis started. And all I can tell you is this. Within the whole SAC command, everything was controlled through command posts. At Commander-in-Chief of SAC, he had a command post. That command post was connected to the three Air Forces, the 2nd, the 15th, and the 8th Air Force. They each had a command post. We were part of the 8th. Every one of the SAC bases had a command post. So the whole SAC system was all controlled through the command post. As I said in that command post, handling all of the aircraft we had on alert, plus all the operations, I was working for the wing commander. If the war had started, and if I was on duty, I was the only one who was authorized to give the command to send all of our planes on alert off the war. The wing commander himself could not come down and say, take off and do such and such. Only the SAC controller could do it. So that was my role during my last 5 years in SAC, and in particular when the Cuban Missile Crisis struck.
How?
At that time, when the Cuban Missile Crisis struck, let me only make this remark. The commander-in-chief of SAC was General Curtis LeMay. Most people have heard of General Curtis LeMay. General Curtis LeMay went to South High School in Columbus, Ohio. He was perhaps the most powerful man in the Air Force. He was the commander-in-chief of SAC. When Kennedy called in all of his advisors, General LeMay was part of those advisory groups because he was chief of staff of the military. What Colonel LeMay told John Kennedy was, turn me loose, I can wipe them off the face of the earth in one day. And let's get them out of our hair forever. Well, obviously, Kennedy said, no, we aren't going to do that. But that is what General Curtis LeMay wanted to do, was to send out his fleet and wipe them off the first of the eighth. I mean, off the face of the earth. Not only did he do that, but he even publicly announced just what they would be facing. He told them how many bombers he had. He told them he had 1,400. He told them how many 52s he had. And the Russians had no doubt in their mind what would have happened. That was my job.
How close do you think it came to war with the Soviet Union during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
It came right down to the very last thing. You know, we put up a blockade, and we said, you run that blockade, and the war is on. And we used to wonder who in the world would be working when and if that happened. I often thought, I wonder if I'd be one of the controllers on duty if they should attempt to run that blockade. As those Russian ships were getting closer and closer to the blockade, everyone just held their breath. Because CINSAC announced, if they run the blockade, you will get the red dot message to go to war. And we just sweated it out. And, of course, they came up to where the blockade was, and they stopped. And they did not attempt to run the blockade. But we didn't know that until it happened. And that's when they stopped, turned around, and went back to Russia.
As
they crossed that blockade, the war was on. Now, that's about as close as you can get to having a nuclear war.
We are chatting with Dr. Harold Brown, author of the book, Keep Your Airspeed Up, The Story of a Tuskegee Airman. Dr. Brown, when you look back on it now, and history looks back on it, we look very highly on the Tuskegee Airmen. Being one of them, one of the originals, what do you think about that group? What are your thoughts? How should it be remembered?
Well, from my point of view, let me start from the time I went. I was a young kid, and all I wanted to do was fly an airplane. And I had no idea the role that we were really playing. And it wasn't until after the war, and I became a little older, a little smarter, a little wiser, we all begin to realize what an important role that we played in the war. And when Truman, as president, in 1948 announced by executive order that he was going to integrate the military, then we realized right then and there that, boy, That is happening for one reason only, because of the outstanding record the 332nd Fighter Group had during the war. Had we not had that record, there is no way that Truman would have said, we are integrating in 1949. So from 1949, when I was on base, I was in an integrated society. The Civil Rights Act was not passed until 1964, and I retired in 1965. So the only time I saw segregation or anything is when I left the base. And there is where I saw it, if I was in the South. But while I was on the base, it did not exist. And as I reflect back and I think of all the things that we did, and I think of all of the challenges, all of the obstacles, no one wanted us. They put every possible roadblock in our way. We were looked upon as the great Tuskegee experiment. They knew it was going to fail. And not only that, but they even helped in that failure by putting up more and more obstacles. And it was just something else that we had to jump through another hoop, another hoop, and another hoop. And when I look back at all the things that we went through, I said, boy, right now, when I go out and talk to kids, I use the lessons of the Tuskegee Airmen, and I use those lessons and that legacy, I talk about the Tuskegee Airmen and everything that we went through. And I cannot think of a better example. If you want to inspire a young kid, encourage him, give him inspiration, than to talk about and tell them the story of the Tuskegee Airmen, because it's that kind of a story. And they are the perfect group to sell this whole ideal. You can become anything you want to become. All you got to do is just work at it and set your goals. And anything is possible today. And when things are bad, just think about the Tuskegee Airmen and what they had to go through. And use the Tuskegee Airmen as your guiding light. And you're in.
It's all very true. I have two quick questions for you here, Dr. Brown, about World War II. Did you think it was a good idea to use the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
As I reflect back, it was a terrible, terrible thing that happened. But I don't see where we had any other choice. When I think what would have happened if they had taken thousands of soldiers and went in to invade Japan, it would have been a mess. Now, we would have won the war, but it would have cost us thousands of soldiers' lives. And that was a choice. Do you risk the lives of all those men, or do you drop the bomb? I say if I had been in that position, I would have said, drop the bomb.
And the other question, being in Nuremberg for your interrogation, the trials happened there years later. Almost all of the people who were put on trial used the defense that they were just following orders. Do you buy that?
Well, for the vast majority of them that was at the top, that was the biggest lie that was ever told. However, I will say this. I learned so much about the Luftwaffe, the Air Force. The Air Force was made up of a group of professional pilots, and they were very professional pilots. They respected us, and we respected them. As a matter of fact, very few of the Luftwaffe were Nazis. They were not part of the nationalistic socialists who made up the Nazis party. As a matter of fact, they were some of the biggest critics of their boss, Hermann Göring, who was over the Luftwaffe, and they talked about him in a horrible way. And they even questioned the sanity of Hitler themselves. So, in terms of the Luftwaffe, those, in my opinion, those were the good guys. And those were the guys who was caught up into a war that they did not want to be caught up in. But for the rest of them, well, those are all of the suspects. And for them, I don't think they were anything like the Luftwaffe. So that's my biased opinion.
Dr. Brown, I want to part with this question because I think it's important. You're a gentleman who's lived the 20th century, all of the 21st century. You've lived in the time of Hitler and Roosevelt and part of the Tuskegee Airmen, the original class, and you were in Nuremberg and you've been a POW. You've been in the segregated South and the integrated North in the 20s and 30s. In 2018, the week of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, what do you make of our president and our country right now, race-wise?
You know, I thought you might ask that question. Well, I'll tell you, I think we have some difficult days ahead. Now, that's a terrible thing to say. But as I listen to this stuff, and I listen to a variety of news. I listen to the Fox News, so I want to hear that side. I listen to CNN, so I want to hear that side. I want to hear both sides of it, so I listen to both sides of it. But I think we have got some real problems. Look at the day, what's going on. Here we are about to what? The government's about to be shut down. And you look at all the tweets and things which comes out of the White House, you wonder, my God, what in the world is going on? What in the world is that man thinking about sending out tweets instead of providing some leadership and saying, this is what I want done, whether it's right or wrong, come out and give them some direction? Because the poor guys over in Congress, they don't know what in the world to do. They come up with one idea, and all of a sudden he shoots it down. Then within matters later, he changes his mind and something else is going on. I don't know how in the world they can even begin to govern. And in fact, there isn't much governing going on right now. It's nothing to just one great big boondoggle. Well, we have got some problems, and I don't know what the solution is. But somebody is going to have to face up to the good president and say, look, you either start providing some leadership or we're going to have to make a change. I don't see how it can be said any other way. And that's a terrible thing to say, but I just don't know if we have any other choice.
Dr. Brown, this is a terrible question to ask, but for somebody who has seen racism and bounded over those barriers, there is a question in the last 2 weeks. When you look and listen to President Trump, do you consider him a racist?
Well, all I can tell you right now is that I have thought about it, I have thought about it, and I'm still thinking about it. I have heard him say things that just scare the hell out of me. I don't want to believe that. That's the last thing that I want to believe. But as difficult as it is, I am beginning to wonder. If he isn't, boy, he is sure starting to sound like it. And that is sad when you say that about the President of the United States.
You know, we bandy the word hero around, but a man who has lived the 20th century, all the 21st century, taught kids, written a great book, Keep Your Airspeed Up, The Story of a Tuskegee Airman, been a POW in Nazi Germany, interrogated in Nuremberg, lived in the integrated South, overcame the obstacles in Tuskegee by the Tuskegee Airmen, for the Tuskegee Airmen. There's no better correlation of words than hero and Dr. Harold Brown. I just, talking to you has made my day. I just can't thank you enough.
Well, it was a pleasure, believe me. I enjoyed the chit-chat. And I hope I didn't get too wordy Now, it didn't take too long in responding to some of your questions, because most of them, I know I talked 5-10 minutes to give you the answer.
The more we know, the better. The best thing I ever learned as an interviewer was I never learned anything when I was talking.
Okay, sir.
That works. I hope our paths cross, being that we're both in Ohio. Thank you, Dr. Brown.
It would be a pleasure.
Take care.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Dr. Robert Brown, an original member of the Tuskegee Airmen. Can't get any better than that. More here on WWGH Radio.
We're currently investigating a fatal crash that occurred on Wednesday, January 17th,